So you probably know the story of that giant horse, you know, the Trojan horse. The story of Helen of Troy is remarkable. So there's this historic moment when the Greek people are fighting the Spartans, and the story is Helen was this Greek woman. Her husband was Menelaus, and a guy named Paris comes from the city of Troy and kidnaps her. Or maybe, we don't know what version is true, or maybe they were lovers and they had a tryst and she was whisked away in the darkness of night. And that began the Trojan War. That began a 10-year battle to rescue her. And the big culmination is the moment when they get this great idea. They've spent years trying to break down the fortifications of the city of Troy, and finally, they construct a huge horse. That's a big deal in Troy because we worship a god whose symbol is a horse. And one morning, the city of Troy, they wake up and they look over the ramparts and they realize the Greeks are gone. Their camp had been burned. Their ships were gone out of the harbor. They were nowhere to be seen. They sent out people and made sure it was true, and there was no trickery at all. Little did they know that gift that they assumed was a gift that says, okay, let's stop the fight. They finally brought the horse into the city, and inside were hidden soldiers. And in the middle of the night, they took the city. Great story. We sort of are amused and captured by the Trojan horse idea. That's the imagery that we've held on to. But the big deal is Helen. You've heard the phrase, hers was the face that launched a thousand ships. Her beauty was so great that Paris of Troy was captured by it, was enamored by it. It was so beautiful, she was so lovely and so charming that her husband could not ever let go of this. And so, even if there was infidelity involved, he still went after her. And they fought the fight. As a matter of fact, there was a moment in the end of it all when he thought about taking her life, when the husband was so wounded, perhaps, by her infidelity that he drew his sword to kill her, but she was too beautiful. He was too captured. He was too in love, and he couldn't do it. I think that's the weight of the story. Her beauty, the romance, the face that launched a thousand ships that kept a war going for 10 years. There's something about that that gets us. There's something about that that becomes, well, mythical, right? This romance that we observe in books and in movies and in lore, it goes to a deeper place in us. Even we guys, we get a little bit sappy when it's really a good love story. Not too syrupy sweet, but one that includes valor, a love story that includes passion, a love story that includes a glorious ending. Here's what I believe. Here's absolutely what I believe. I think we're drawn to those stories not just because of the romance, but because of the beauty that launches a thousand ships, because of the glory of it all. What I'm getting at is this. Here's my theology. This is the big stuff. I think we were made for glory. I think we were made for glory. Don't take my word for it. Listen to Jesus's words. He says this in John 17. John 17 is the end of Jesus's story, is at the end of his life. And what does he think about? You and me. He says this. He's speaking to his father and he says, I have given them the glory. The glory that you gave me, so that they can be one as you and I are one, I in them and you in me. May they experience such perfect unity that the world will know that you sent me and that you love them as much as you love me. That's what I believe. I think that glory that we love in songs and in poetry and in story is because we were made for glory. This is pretty amazing. I think there was this sense of unity between God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. And out of the beauty of their perfect unity, out of their glorious unity, that's when they said, we need to share this with somebody. And so God created us in his image. And he gave us glory. You catch that? The same glory that they have is what he's given, not is going to give, but has given to us. We love that story because it rings true. It's familiar. That's our story. When we read those love stories, it resonates with us because that's us. That's supposed to be us. We're supposed to be moved by glory. It's supposed to go to a deeper place. Here's the rub. Here's the problem. The problem is, I believe in glory. I believe in transcendence. I believe that we can be transformed, that we can be renovated. I lead a church named Renovation. The Latin word is renovatus. The rub is this. While I think people can change, there's a voice inside me that says, you can change, but I can't. It's too late for me. I've made too many foolish decisions. I'm too used. I'm too broken. I can't handle this anymore. I've tried and I failed. And I think people can change, except this one. So we're going to start this new series at the Renovatus Church. It's called Conflicted. And if you've ever been at a place where you thought, I'm too damaged, I've gone too far, I'm thinking about other people, but I'm too stuck, this may be a message of hope because we believe in butterflies. Tonight, as a matter of fact, I don't want to talk to butterflies. I want to talk to caterpillars. This is a reality that a caterpillar has no wings, okay? But the next 5 weeks is going to be flight school. The next five weeks is going to be conversations about caterpillars, to caterpillars, but it's going to be with an eye on what God had in mind. I don't know if a caterpillar ever gets in his head that, man, someday if I have wings, I'm going to go to... There's this internal conflict that happens in all of us. Frankly, I wish it were just you. Then we could all pat you on the shoulder and say, yeah, it really stinks to be you. But the truth is, we all get to moments in our life where we're going, I give up. I can't do this. I can't be good enough. I can't be honorable enough. I want all the right things, but it's not in me. This is going to be 5 weeks of training, 5 weeks of rethinking, 5 weeks of trusting. The first bit of advice is trust the system. God knew about caterpillar life. He knew what's going to happen in the chrysalis. He knows about the beauty that is before us. And so you may not be convinced, but I want to challenge you to trust the system and trust that God does have you in mind. Could we just stop right there and pray about that? That's pretty big. So God, right now we're trying to pay attention. We're trying to hear your voice, but the truth is, caterpillar language rattles around in our head so honestly and so genuinely and so loudly that it's just hard for us to grasp. So if you would tonight give us the courage to trust you just a little bit so that we can hear what you're creating in us all. In Jesus' name, amen. So that process that I'm talking about, that metamorphosis, let's talk about caterpillar life. All moths and all butterflies start out in that larval stage. And there's varying numbers of legs. In the business we call them prolegs. And shapes and sizes and colors. The biggest deal that all of us caterpillars have in common is we've got a remarkable future. Another lesser thing is we have a voracious appetite. Caterpillars are remarkable eaters. They are eating machines. From the moment that the egg hatches, they begin snacking, and they do that for the rest of their existence, getting ready for the chrysalis, getting ready for that time when they are shut up and no longer able to graze. They have interesting systems, varying systems between caterpillars on how to deal with predators. Not exactly are they feisty fighters, at least I'm not, but caterpillars have remarkable things like some of them are furry, fuzzy. Some of them actually have prickly things that stick out that just make them uncomfortable to eat, that just give a texture that doesn't feel like food. Some of them have aposematic colors. That is, they have colors that say, you don't want to eat me because I have poisons, I have toxins, I have bad flavor, I have bad smells, I'm kind of aggressive if you eat me. Some of them have defensive systems so that as soon as a bird tries to peck at them, they begin to flip and flop, and it's a little bit off-putting for the birds, and so they make flight, and they live another day. Some of them really are poisonous and are toxic and will take out the predators. Some of them have an appearance that is deceitful. There'll be caterpillars that their rear end actually looks like the head of a large beetle. And they've got an appearance that says, I'm a large, dangerous bug, and so you probably don't want to mess with me. Some of them have camouflage that makes them invisible. As a matter of fact, when they hatch from one species, when it hatches from the egg, they always are hatched in an oak tree, and the larva will come out as a leafy green that matches oak trees exactly. But as they continue to grow and develop, they eat their way down to, well, the bark, and when they get that far, they change to a barky color brown. My favorite is one that I've mentioned before, is the walnut sphinx, that when a bird pecks at him, he whistles. If I come back as a bug, I think I want to choose a walnut sphinx. I just think it'd be cool to whistle, but that's off the subject. Theologically, I want for us to talk about caterpillar brain. The rub is when we get in a mindset that says, this is my life, this is what I can do, this is all I know. We can't talk about flight because it's just so beyond what we're able to absorb. Caterpillar brain is understandable. Caterpillar brain is not unreasonable. It's just not helpful either. So when I get in my caterpillar brain mindset, I do what all caterpillars. If I spend the next 5 weeks trying to say calipitters, it's going to be amusing for you, but frustrating for me. So let's talk about caterpillars. If I get stuck in that mindset, that brain set that I'm talking about, I'm going to do what caterpillars do. I'm just going to put my head down and I'm going to consume. I'm going to start eating. I'm going to start collecting. I'm going to start taking in more. I'm just going to follow my appetites. I'm just going to do those things that give me just a little bit of satisfaction, a little bit of, well, I don't know about tomorrow, but there's this right in front of me. And so we accumulate, and so we invest in things that are temporary, and so we become consumers. Or I'm going to, if that's not enough to keep me alive, I'll keep alive by trickery, by deceit, and I'll do what I have to do to stay alive one more day. And so I'll bristle and I'll send out warnings and I'll put on my camo gear and I'll do whatever I need to do just to stay alive one more day. We consume and we pretend. We consume and we pretend. And I'm telling you, you can live your whole life being a consumer and putting on a great act, but never become who you were designed to be. There's far more caterpillars that never make it to butterflyhood. There's more caterpillars that die in the larva stage, and that's a tragedy. And there's far too many human beings who are created in the image of God that He has a bigger dream, but they sell out to how they feel at the moment and they give up. And it's because they have no sense of glory. That's what's missing. That's what's missing in our world. That's what's missing in our communities. That's what's missing at work. That's what's missing at school. That's what's missing is this sense that I was made for something bigger than this, something more. I had a little girl get on my school bus. And she's in first grade, and she's charming, but she lives in her own world. And it's hard to get much out of her, and she doesn't have much to say. But one day, she gets on the bus. She marches up to me and gets my attention. So we're looking at each other eyeball to eyeball. And she said, "Tomorrow, I'm going to change the world." And she walked to her seat and sat down. And I drove away from her, stopped thinking, I think I believe her. I don't know what God's going to do, but I think He's waiting for some people that say, I have a destiny. My life may not make sense, but it's in the right place. It's in His hands. Consuming and pretending, it keeps us alive. But it's ignoring our butterflyhood. We were made for metamorphosis. We were made for change. So I just want to caution you to be thoughtful and cautious about resisting change, because God may be found on the other side of that adventure. And so in the next 5 weeks, we're going to do a sketch, just a quick glance at the book of Colossians. The Apostle Paul wrote this book. It's his seventh letter. Most of his books, 13 of the 27 books in the New Testament, were written by him. 9 of those are letters that he wrote to local churches, and they're personal. Most of the churches are groups of people that he knows, churches that he started, but not Colossae. As a matter of fact, the church that he wrote to in Colossae, which is now modern-day Turkey, was actually written to 3 churches. There were 3 communities of Jesus believers in Colossae, in Laodicea, and in Hierapolis. And so one would receive the letter and then pass it on to the next church, and they kept passing on his words. The big deal about this neighborhood is it was a major trade route for the Roman Empire. And so the big deal about Colossae is it was a Roman colony. That means all of its citizens were citizens of Rome. That means that they had special privileges. That meant that they had a higher economic standing. That meant that they had some protection that most of the Roman Empire didn't know or experience at all. And so Paul, probably through a friend of his, comes to know this church, and he writes this letter. So I'm giving you some homework. Start reading the book of Colossians. It's in the New Testament. It's toward the back. It's only 4 chapters. It won't take you long to read. I would even encourage you to read it a few times this week. There's some interesting things going on in the city of Colossae. And in this church, most churches in this area have a lot of Jewish people in them, and there's a lot of Jewish heritage, not in Colossae, not in this area. They came to find Jesus, but they didn't have any of that rich history that the Hebrews would bring into things, and so they fell in love with Jesus. But Paul writes this story to them when it's time to make some changes, and it's hard. And some of them are giving up, and some of them are stepping back, and some of their shoulders are drooping, and they're going, I'm not having as much fun as I was. Maybe this was a bad idea. Something interesting happened for all three of these cities. They had 2 major earthquakes that leveled all 3 cities in 17 AD and in 60 AD. All 3 of these cities were leveled. Huge crisis, huge turmoil. Each time, all 3 cities rebuilt, but each time it was with less glory. And so Paul's dealing with people that have just been beat down, and they're tired. They're in a situation that, because it's a trade route, there's also all sorts of cultural influences that are coming into things, and people are stepping into their faith community with lots of new ideas, and they're kind of going, well, what about that? And what about this? And all of a sudden, the things that they heard and learned about Jesus when they first came to faith were wearing a little bit thin. They were trying to match their expectations to what they first learned, and it's not exactly tidy. And living as a caterpillar is not a fun existence. And so as you read, especially pay attention to chapters 1 and 2, notice some of the empty philosophies. That's a phrase that Paul uses in the 8th verse of the very first chapter. Some of the empty philosophies that were coming in. He says, you're hearing some things, you're making some choices, and if I could rephrase his words, he said, you're sort of getting stuck in caterpillar brain. Be aware that there are influences that you aren't necessarily going to find helpful, but they may confuse you. As a matter of fact, in verse 17, he uses this great expression where he says, you want reality? Christ is the reality. He's reminding them that who they are in Jesus is who they really are. And he's hammering it down. So as you read this week, I want to challenge you to think in terms of what that looks like. Notice in your reading that some of the changes that he describes happen instantly. You accept Jesus, and there is a newness, and there's a freshness, and some changes come over you. That's beautiful. And some changes involve journey, involve process. And so he's reminding them what I've said to you, and that is, trust the process. Some things come quickly and easily, other things do not. Transition, process, it creates internal and external conflict. But the conflict and the heat and the intensity, it's not something that he's saying, you just got to endure this. He's challenging them to think in terms of, and you may find God in this mix. Don't panic. Don't fall apart. But before we close up tonight, I want to introduce you to just 2 verses. There's 2 places that I want you to watch for. One is in chapter 1, verses 21 through 23. Listen to this. You, says Paul, were once far away from God. You were his enemies, separated from him by evil. But now he has reconciled you to himself through the death of Christ, and as a result, he has brought you into his own presence, and you are holy and blameless as you stand before him without a single fault. Listen to this next line. He says, but you must continue to believe this truth and stand firmly in it. Don't drift away from the assurance that you received when you heard the good news. He said, wait. This caterpillar brain that you're dealing with right now is causing you to think, I don't feel holy. I don't feel pure. And he's saying, no. You instantly stood before God because of Jesus, blameless. You are holy. Could I just encourage you to tell the devil once in a while, excuse me, I know what you're trying to tell me about me, but the truth about me is I'm holy. I'm blameless. I'm pure. I'm righteous. This is not someday out there. This is right now. This is who I am. That's powerful. He says, stand firm in that, caterpillar boy. Stand firm in that. Don't forget who you are. One of the best tools of the enemy is to remind us of who we used to be. The second verse I want you to look at is chapter 2, verses 6 through 13. He says, and now, just as you accepted Jesus Christ as Lord, you must continue to follow him. Let your roots go down deep into him, and let your lives be built on him. Then your faith will grow strong in the trust in the truth that you were taught, and you will overflow through thankfulness. He says, hang in there. Remember who you are. It takes journey. It takes process. Let your roots grow. It's a slow process. It's hard to see a root grow, but it happens. And there's moments when finally, after weeks and weeks, something pops up through the soil and there's hope of growth. I hope you'll embrace the mystery of Jesus. Because, well, like Paul said, he's your reality. He's the truth. He's the only place where you're going to find hope. Because he sees you as the butterfly that you are. He sees you for what he created you to be. As a matter of fact, you are the focus of a battle that has not gone on for 10 years, but you are the focus of a battle that has been going on for eons. Do you hear me? But Kevin, what about my past? And what about my wounds? And what about my mistakes? And what about my foolishness? And what about my choices? And to you, I would say, what about Helen of Troy? What if there was some creation of God that was so beautiful, so captivating, that she would launch 1,000 ships? My friend, your name is Helen. Helen the caterpillar. Who would have known? But the truth is, he doesn't look at you and see a worm. He looks at you and see what he created. I know. It's conflicting, right? We're going to take several weeks to sort of process this together. So we'll talk some more next Sunday evening. I would encourage you to do that reading. But I want you to sort of settle into this fact. He has done anything and everything to come after you. You may not feel beautiful. You may not be convinced. But frankly, It doesn't matter what you think. What matters is what he thinks. And he thinks you're beautiful. And he's coming after you. And he's desperate. And Kevin, what if I've sort of, what if I've been having an affair on God? What if I wasn't kidnapped? What if I actually chose to be with the enemy? This is crazy. So we have to sort of retell the story in mythology. But the truth is, he doesn't care. He's captured you, and he made provision for you to be holy and pure and blameless. This week, live out of that truth.